Well, if you're not in Matthew chapter 5, we'll be looking at those few verses in 27 to 30, and a little bit after that, 31, 32. As we look at dealing with our thought life and growing in our marriages and relationships, as we're in this series on the Sermon on the Mount, the greatest sermon ever preached, we're calling it, because it is the Sermon of Jesus Christ. And it's about our character growing and Christ working through us. It's not about us trying to live up to moral standards and make ourselves better, but about Christ changing us into His image and renewing us in character to follow Him as disciples. And so we see some key points here about really how does that apply to our marriages, but also there's some general principles about our relationships and about how we deal with our thought life and temptation and how we make those, how God makes those relationships stronger when it comes to growing as a disciple in Christian character. So number one thing that we want to see here about growing in our Christian character and relationships in verse 27, but also verses 31 and 32 that we'll look at, is make a commitment to God's standards. As God gives you grace, of course, we're talking here in this first point about making a commitment to His truth and His standards. And we're looking in this series, of course, about Jesus taking us in a deeper walk with God. That's why He came, not to do away with the law, but to fulfill it and to show us what the law means for our walk with God, how it reveals the character and truth of who God is. And so it's about His Holy Spirit, the Sermon on the Mount, living through us as He transforms us inwardly and gives us God's wisdom and perspective on life. And we've seen, as we began last week with the commandment of murder, Christ didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the full intent of it so that we'll really know who God is. And then we're looking at how this affects our relationships, and especially today when it comes to marriage. But it applies, of course, to other relationships as well and the principles. As we saw last week, Christ living in a Christian takes, we saw last week, what could be the worst, physically taking someone's life in murder, and progressively turns it into the best. As we as Christians are those who can see others the way God sees them and see the value of human life and respect it and then deal with our emotions in the right way. We talked about anger, very practical message about that, dealing with that. But God can take the worst that commandment stands for and help us grow in a godly way in the best so that we grow in love for Him and for others. Well, this week, Christ gets specific in a way, more specific, as He deals with the seventh commandment that, of course, we know, if you know God's law, deals with adultery, forbidding the act of adultery, and thou shalt not commit adultery. We saw last Sunday, Christ follows this pattern, doesn't He, as He's dealing with the Old Testament law in the Sermon on the Mount, the Old Testament understanding that Jesus stands on. He said, I didn't come to do away with that. In this case, it's do not commit adultery. But then, you see, in the time, that intertestamental period of 400 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Pharisees were to come in and hold people to the law. But instead, they misinterpreted the law. They missed the boat on what it really meant. And they were looking at the law superficially, not going deep enough, missing the true intent of God's truth and law. And in this case, the Pharisees were teaching that as long as you don't physically carry out the act of adultery, you don't physically go and sleep with another person. And he's really honing in here, especially on men, but of course it applies, of course, to women doing that as well and breaking this commandment. They were kind of saying, as long as you haven't done that physical act of adultery, you're okay. You haven't broken it. They didn't get the real heart of what this commandment, the seventh, is all about. And in that day, women, in fact, as Jesus goes to point out later in verses 31 and 32, they were treated like property, just like in the day of Moses. This is what it's referring to there in 31 and 32, that God had allowed that a man could divorce his wife as long as he gave what was a certificate of divorce, because the women were being treated so poorly in the time. Of course, the men were misusing that advantage, getting the certificate of divorces for any reason imaginable. The silliest things, if they didn't like their cooking, You know, and seriously, because the woman let the food rot and go too bad. All these types of issues that can be cited. It's even more extreme than our no-fault divorce laws that you often see today, where it's just divorce is treated so lightly. I did like this story that I read, true story from years ago, where this sheriff's department in Florida in the U.S., apparently they had set it up to where if you committed adultery, you'd be suspended in that sheriff's department. And the guy said, Dennis Fowler, his reason is that adultery is not a victimless crime, he said. Rather, it's created difficulties within this department that go past just the married couple, the offenders. Now, you don't really see that very often in society, do you, people taking a stand like that? But you see, most people are glad, of course, as we looked at the law about murder last week, people are glad for that on a superficial level, right? They don't understand the depths of it. They're glad that there's this law covering don't murder, most people. But they don't really like or think that greatly about this particular commandment. Most people would think you should hold up the commandment don't murder, but thou shalt not commit adultery. It's a different story in society. And I think this is why in this context Jesus is emphasizing so clearly what we would think of as the surface level understanding of this commandment. He wants to go deeper, but he's really trying to emphasize what was going on, how people were abusing it, and the importance of what God says about it. Jesus said this is God's standard, God's will, because God has a purpose in marriage. And that's why we need to make a commitment, as God shows us that, to the standards that he tells us in his word, and especially here with marriage. Even if you're not married, even if you're divorced, or even if you're single, or you're a young person, to really make a commitment and understand what God has to say about the value of importance of marriage. It's as if Jesus reminds them there's a reason for God's law. You've got to start there. And there, of course, are good reasons we know why adultery is so deadly and why it's wrong. Because it destroys, in many times, irreparable ways, the marriage relationship. Adultery is such a serious sin emphasized by Jesus because it's the most grievous of sexual sins in that sense, because God has established the marriage to be of one woman and one man, and then the adultery affects that in such a deadly way. It's not that it can't be fixed or restored, but it's difficult. Number two, it defames the relationship that marriage represents. That's why adultery is so bad, and Jesus emphasizes it. The act of physical adultery, especially, breaks the bonds of marriage, of which is a lifelong marriage covenant of a husband and wife, and that represents God's faithfulness. We talked about that this morning. His loyalty and his relationship with his church. It defames that. The word literally, adultery, is of course the concept of something being pure and being polluted. Adulterated, something pure and God-given in love is destroyed and defamed. It was pure, but it's like somebody takes your morning coffee and it's so pure and wonderful and they put oil into it. Or they put the wrong milk, or they put sour milk in there. It adulterates it. That's just a small little picture as we think about how we like our coffee in the morning. But someone once said that if we can betray the trust of the man or the woman we vow to spend our lives with, depending on the husband or wife, wherever you are, because of temptation, because of lust, because we want something more, then how can we be trusted for anything else? Now, does this mean we don't ever have any struggles with anything in our lives, in our thought life? Of course not. Does this mean there can't be forgiveness and restoration? Of course there can be. But that it means, Jesus says, take this seriously. Understand the depths of what this sin is all about, and understand the standard of God's command. It's like that oil that goes in the coffee. It's not meant to be there. It makes the coffee undrinkable. It pollutes it. And it's hard to get the oil. If you put oil in the coffee, it'd be hard to get the oil out of that. Something that was once pure is adulterated. When sex takes place in any other way than between the husband and wife, something that God designed is very beautiful and wonderful and powerful, is broken. When a married man or woman breaks covenant with God and then with each other, That's what the extreme sin is that Jesus is talking about here, that this commandment covers the worst case scenario, and it does the greatest damage. We're going to talk about other sins that this commandment also covers, but that one, when there's a physical act of adultery, does the greatest damage to that marriage covenant. Why? Because from the very beginning, God intended that there be one marriage between one man and one woman. There be marriage in that context. Jesus said in Matthew, "In the beginning, Creator made them male and female." And he said, "For this reason will a man leave his father and mother and be united or cleave with his wife, and the two will become one flesh." That's in Mark and Matthew. God's ideal was and always been that there's one man and one woman for marriage, for life. That's the ideal. It doesn't mean that God can't restore when that falls and when that's hurt. But that's the ideal, to protect the marriage covenant. That's why God gives us this commandment. Don't commit adultery, to protect that covenant between a man and a woman. We're made in the image of God, and God is faithful to us, loyal to us as the bride of Christ. And God is married to His saved church spiritually. Even though we are unfaithful, as we talked about this morning, God is always faithful. And it's through Jesus Christ that God is remaking each of us as a part of that church into the image of God. And that image includes faithfulness in our relationships. And especially faithfulness here we're talking about in marriage. So one of the things we can do to try to encourage this and commitment to God's standards, of course, is that we reaffirm that. Sometimes couples, you know, they renew their vows. It's not a bad thing to do. But we reaffirm our commitment in our marriages to one another, and we support that. Even if we're not married, we do what we can to support God's design, His institution of marriage, and that we've got that commitment. We affirm that to our friends, our relatives, the people we work with, where we stand on this issue. As God gives us opportunity to speak up, we want that to shine through. And probably the best thing we can do is for it to shine through in our example and our model as Christian married couples. The bottom line is, if we're going to communicate and make an impact, we've got to communicate the seriousness of God's standard on marriage. Talk about it to our children. Talk about it, what God says in His Word, to those in our church. Help the next generation to understand the value and the power of what God has given in marriage. Realizing that, of course, there's restoration and forgiveness when there's been hurt, there's been divorce, and there's been sin. But to not lose sight of what God says marriage is all about and why it's so important. It stands for God's faithfulness, God's loyalty experienced in our lives, pictured in marriages, of the kind of love and loyalty that God has that's seen within the context of that marriage relationship. The ramifications of the sin of adultery are so great. So if you're single, maybe you ask God for the strength to stay focused on what you're called to do. If you're widowed or older, if there's someone like that, there's encouragement that people can always give to the next generation. We need to remember that. Because we live in a time, don't we, where divorce is just such a huge reality in the world today. So many people, even in the church, have struggled with this. And we need to be encouraging to those and remind people of what God's grace is all about and how He restores. And thank God for that grace. But we have to always remember God's ideal is never divorce. It's always that there be a marriage between a husband and a wife for life. So many people, unfortunately, in the time we live in, we know, have that little escape hatch that they go into the marriage with, don't they? Well, if it doesn't work out, we can always go this way. There's always that little key. And to leave the marriage, to get out and dispose of it, like we talked about this morning. People don't want to make commitments. But God says, throw away that key if you're a Christian couple. And encourage others to understand why marriage is so essential. Yes, we know the Bible talks about some scriptural exceptions when one's mate or partner, married partner, is committed adultery against you. There can be restoration, but that's one example. And certainly when a believer is deserted by an unbelieving spouse, then of course divorce and remarriage, as Jesus talked about, I believe, would be permitted. But marriage between one man and one woman is always God's design and the picture of His love and relationship to His church. It's only in the marriage that God shows us what real love is about. It's in that marriage relationship that they grow together in commitment and learn sacrifice for someone else and become less focused on their own wants in a way that perhaps is hard and doesn't happen oftentimes outside of marriage. Think about it. Any breaking of this command is rooted, isn't it, in selfishness. Lust, not love, not sacrifice. Selfish desires. People get into sexual immorality because of self-centeredness and lust as well. Not because of love, as they often think. They get into adultery. They turn away from their marriage because of lust, not love. So that's the first key that we got to remember here is make a commitment to God's standards. If we want to grow, we want others to grow in relationships and especially in marriage, if we want to grow in making an impact in that area. Number two, Jesus says we need to manage our minds. Manage our minds. Verse 28. Now, the fact is we must make that commitment to God's standards no matter what phase of life we're in. But remember the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus, we saw last week, in the last couple weeks, He's taking us beneath the surface when it comes to God's law. He wants us to see more about God's law and how it represents who God really is, His character. And so He wants us to grow in our love for the Lord and for His law. And He came to fulfill the law, not to do away with it, but to save us from our condemnation under it and to help us to walk in it and to grow through the law of God. As we saw last Sunday, all of God's commands explicitly, of course, forbid the worst sin that you tend to think of when you think about the Ten Commandments, right? They prohibit also, though, we saw last week, and this is true with this command, all the other sins that lead up to that extreme case that the commandment deals with. So any act in this particular command, the seventh commandment, it's forbidding any act or thought that in some way might adulterate the marriage or could lead to that point of actual adultery. It's a violation of the command. The commandment forbids all the sins of sexual immorality that people get into, sex before marriage, living together, cohabitating out of wedlock, homosexuality, pornography, wrong thought life, flirtation at the office, what people today would say are emotional affairs. All these things that are not the extreme worst of breaking the commandment are covered under what God desired and designed for giving us this commandment to reveal His character and what He desires. Why? Because through those sins, though they might not necessarily lead to the actual breaking of the marriage covenant, though they could, they adulterate, they distort what God intended true marriage to really be about. You know, the fact is when people do go away from their marriage or they get into affairs, it doesn't begin with the physical. It always begins with the mental. For men, we know the dangers of pornography and visual images and flirtation and all these things, what it can lead to. I was reading about the stats. These are old statistics as well, that a person would view sexual material more than 10,000 times a year in some way, in TV or whatever else that they see. By a ratio of more than 10 to 1, couplings on TV involve sex outside of marriage. And we, of course, know how the homosexual lifestyle is pushed so hard in the media. The stats said 9 of 10 kids in this survey that they did between the ages of 8 and 16 will somehow be exposed to these images. Furthermore, 47% of school-age students and children receive spam like this of a pornographic nature of some way. And of course, kids see violence and all these things on TV in so many different ways as well. They studied in 2006, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they studied over 1,000 adolescents, 12 to 14, over a period of 2 years. And during that time, the teens were exposed to 264 episodes on movies, TV shows, music, and magazines. And they saw their sexual content and all the things there And they said they were exposed to higher levels of this, and they would then, the study said, tend to go towards carrying those out in some way. So one explanation, of course, they said in the study was the increase of wrong sexual activity came often from parents letting the kids let the TV and all these things be the parent, essentially. See, this is why we've got to always ask God to help us to understand what's going on and to see what's happening in our thought life. Because the battle is always going on in the mind. And this might not be for you, but it might be for somebody else you impact, that you have influence over. The battle's always in the mind, in the thought life. The problems that come with immorality and marriage and divorce and all these things. So we always have to ask ourselves, as I did last week, and I always have to ask myself, what are we taking in? More of God's truth or more of the trash and the things that are around us? And it's a constant battle. But what we put in our mind is going to come out in our lifestyle. If we want to grow, we've got to change more and more what's being fed into us. If we want kids to avoid sin, if we want them to grow to be faithful husbands and wives, we've got to think about that. If we want that for our grandchildren, for our nieces or our nephews, are we praying this for them, that they'll understand God's design, that they'll understand the impact of what happens in their thinking? Because it's a huge impact. If we're going to grow in faithfulness in the family, we've got to understand what happens in our minds. Because in our thinking, it affects our attitudes. And then the attitude flow out into our behavior, into our actions. That's a clear biblical teaching that sometimes gets overlooked, that we need to remember. We've got to manage our mind. Of course, we can't control everything that comes in and out of our mind. But sometimes people just open up the floodgates, you know. You can be so open-minded that your brains fall out, you know, as some people say. They just open up the floodgates to everything that's out there. But the battle is won or lost many times in the mind. And that's what Jesus is getting at here. What comes through our eyes, as he says later in Matthew 6, 22, 23, that affects our behavior. What we see can stimulate the old flesh that's still there to lead into other things. And we're only going to be changed as we're renewed in our minds. Romans 12, 2. So God cares about, Jesus is showing here, why we do what we do, not just what we do. Why we do it. Daniel Doriani tells about this time. He's a pastor in America, and he written some commentaries and books I have, and I like his story sometimes. But he was a teenager or a young man working at this construction site. They had terrible language and all of this. And actually, he was in seminary at the time. And they kind of gave him a hard time about that. But they realized he was genuine. And they saw something different in him. And he was able to talk to them. And one time he just said, because they'd make all these comments about women, you know. And he finally just said to one of them, you know, you got so much to say about women. Why don't you just tell me about some of these things? You know, and of course, he had nothing to say. And this guy actually said, well, no, I'm always faithful to my wife. And this puzzled Daniel Doriani, and he was talking to one of the other crew members, and he said, well, now I don't understand. This guy's really faithful to his wife, the way he talks, the way he acts. And he said, yeah, but you got to understand, his wife would clobber him if he tried to do anything wrong. She's bigger and stronger than he is. Now, I'll tell you that story. Why? Because the seventh commandment isn't just about us on the outside saying, I'm going to be what I'm supposed to be and not do this when our hearts aren't right. Because God wants us to grow. Again, the Sermon on the Mount is about us being changed from the inside to love His law and to know what His law means and to want to follow it from our hearts, because we love God and we're growing to love others. And of course, in this case, that would be your spouse. So the seventh commandment teaches us not only about the surface level physical acts of adultery or sexual impurity, but it goes beneath the surface to deal with the intentions of our hearts. Not just those actions that even show up in pornography or lust or any of those things that will lead to unfaithfulness. It's dealing with the intents of our hearts. Is there a growing love for God and others? He wants to deal with that. When we turn away and when we want to go do something wrong from our hearts, and it shows up in some action, what we see, what we do, it's because there's something wrong in the heart. He wants to deal with our hearts. What's motivating us to act differently? He's going beneath the surface to our thought life to see what he wants us to see, what God wants us to see, where the sin is flowing from. Only God can see that, but God will bring us conviction. He'll help us to see and go beneath the surface. See, Jesus cares more about not just the physical act of adultery, though certainly he cares about that. He came to deal with our hearts and motives, the intents of our life, our thought life, our hearts and motives. You see, we want to tend to stay beneath, above the surface in our pride. But Jesus came to deal with that self-righteousness. Jesus says, no, there's a whole other picture here. God wants to grow and develop people who are thinking and feeling and acting more like him, because we know what his character is in his law, including, of course, our relationships here, especially in our marriage relationships here. But there's principles that apply with all of our relationships with this. God cares about our intent and what it means and where that intent could lead to. If it's not of his love, if it's not growing in his love and then to love others, he wants to deal with that. He wants to deal with our thinking, our emotions, our minds, our hearts. He says that if that man, or and it can be a woman too, looks with intent at another woman, that man, and goes beyond the first look to the development of thoughts and imaginations that are wrong, looking lustfully, literally it says here, with intent, with a second glance, with a continued imagination and fascination, he could commit adultery in his heart. So Jesus is forbidding the second look here. The godly man, and of course it applies to women in ways as well, of course, don't take that second look, or by God's grace they learn to look differently. Someone said wandering eyes or sensual eyes and ultimately adulterous eyes. The ESV calls it a lustful intent. The original Greek says literally in order to lust after her. Jesus does not, of course, forbid the normal reaction of our humanity, of where we appreciate beauty and God's grace, but he forbids the deep-seated lust that consumes the inner man, the inner person, as someone said. The point is not that we don't admire the beauty of God's creation, but that we don't lust after it, looking at it from the heart with intent, and in the marriage relationship with somebody or towards somebody other than your spouse, with the intention of desiring them, thinking about them, letting imaginations run wild about them. Lustful intent for women, because I picked on the men. Sometimes it can be the things that are read by women, novels, all these things that get in their minds about romance that they wish they had that they didn't at the time, that can turn into, of course we know, wrong conversations, emotional attractions. Looking lustfully is not thinking the person is attractive or pretty, but going further than that and dwelling on it more. A.B. Bruce says, the look is not casual but persistent, the desire not involuntary but momentary. It's cherished. It's not the first glance that's sin, he says, but the second that swells and feeds upon the subject. It's lust here he's talking about. It's the intent of our heart that God's getting at, wanting more than what God has given us. And we know with sin that's based in pride, isn't it? And a lack of thankfulness to God for what he's given us. A lack of contentment and joy, resting in the goodness of God, wanting something more. Someone said, in many cases, a legitimate need in our lives is twisted into something of too great importance, too great a priority. We try to fulfill it in the wrong way, and love becomes lust, food becomes happiness, and money becomes significance. We have to be careful. Our culture is constantly bombarding us with things that feed in our flesh, our selfish desires, isn't it? You know, in marriage, it can be, you know, well, you know, you got to get better than this, you know, you deserve better. Sometimes even parents can do this, Lord, and what they say to make you think, well, you know, you deserve better than this. It's that idea, I can get more, I can do better, I deserve better. And so people lust after that. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's relationships. Maybe it's a different spouse. Maybe it's somebody that you're taking it in from the world that, hey, I can do better than that. they'll treat me differently. This is what happens. But God tells us to grow content in Him, to rest in what He's given us, and wherever point of life we are, to trust Him, enjoy what He's given us, and trust in Him most of all, and ask Him to give us what we need in that situation, because we're thankful. Someone put it this way: commitment somewhere along the way will mean being willing to be unhappy for a while. Somewhere in the journey, talking about marriage here, in the marriage, your commitment will require you to be willing to be unsatisfied or unhappy for a season until things get better. There are some people who have the attitude, well, if I could just get out, if I could just be with this other person, if I could just have this relationship, things would be better. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. No, it isn't. It's greener where you water it. And sometimes we forget that. What's going on in the marriage? Lust is based in discontent and pride and covetousness as we desire what we see, what others have. But what the only thing that changes us is as that's replaced and we grow at experiencing God's love, His everlasting grace, and the contentment and joy that flows out of that, and the grateful heart that flows out of it. And so that we see, God wants us to see who He really is, the loyalty and love and faithfulness, like we talked about this morning, that He's given us in so many ways, so that we'll grow then to experience that faithfulness and love and loyalty, and we'll see it at work in our lives, and it applies, of course, to our marriages, as well as we want to see that in other people's marriages, that we respect and see the great value of what God has given in our relationships and in our marriages. We have to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, as Paul said. That's the way that we change. And that leads me to the third thing here. Not only make a commitment to God's standards, manage your mind, but third, minimize the opportunities for sin. Minimize the opportunities for sin. And we see it in verse 29 there. The hyperbole that Jesus uses here that we're going to look at, of cutting off your right hand if it causes you to sin, gouging out your eye if that causes you to sin. In other words, it's analogy. It's teaching us about, it's using exaggeration to make a clear point about the seriousness that we have about our sin. See, a lot of times the danger is that we tend to want to take the middle ground, right? To say, hey, everything will be okay. You know, we might even throw in there, God's in control. But we don't take the sin seriously the way Jesus said that we could, because of anything that's getting in between us and God, and then between a married couple, for example, can be dangerous. Job said, I made a covenant with my eyes. There are times we need to walk away from things, don't we? Turn things off. Things that can hurt us, that the world might let go, and people that aren't Christians don't think anything about. But we understand the dangers. We understand the vicious cycle and the snowball effect. It's kind of like, you know, the old saying of the teenager who wants to get so far to the edge of the cliff, how close they can get without going off. But the more you get to the edge of the cliff, the rocks start to slip and they don't hold onto your feet the way that you thought that they would. And you lose your grip. And sometimes we can be that way in our pride with our sin. Martin Luther said this. He said, we can't stop the birds from flying over our heads, but we can keep them for sure from building a nest there in our hair. Now, what did he mean by that, Martin Luther? We can't stop temptations and thoughts and seeing things that we shouldn't, but we can certainly be guarded. And we can minimize the opportunities for sin. 2 Corinthians 10 says to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. The temptations that are there, things running through our mind, to be vigilant about it. It's a bit like this whole thing with the hand washing, right? We might look at it, you know, sometimes and say, oh, wow, you know, got to do that. I mean, somebody I read or listened to the other day said, wash your hands every 20 minutes, you know, I mean, okay, it seems a little bit extreme, you know, talking about this whole coronavirus thing, you know, every 20 minutes, you know, if you're out somewhere, come back in, take a bath. Now, see, do we look at our sin that way, though? That, hey, you know, I'm okay. I'm not going to catch anything. I'm not going to fall into it. I'm good with this? Or do we look to the Lord depending on Him? And like Jesus says here, if there are things that are getting in the way, do we see the seriousness of that sin? Or are we minimizing the sin? We need to be minimizing the opportunities for sin, but do we minimize sometimes the seriousness of what that sin can lead to? And that's why Jesus uses what could be seen as grotesque imagery here of gouging out an eye. He's not saying literally if your eyes cause you to sin, gouge it out physically, but that you don't look at that thing. If that's leading you to sin, what's coming through your eyes, you have to make a drastic call sometimes. If your feet are leading you to do things that are going to lead you into sin and further sin, then you learn to not go there. You make a call. You make a commitment. You minimize the opportunity. Whatever that sin is, here he's especially talking about the dangers of lust and what it leads to in adultery and the effects on marriage. But you could apply it to a number of different areas of your sin. Are you willing to take that stand? You don't physically cut off your hand. But if your hand's leading you, something you're doing, and that, what you're doing is leading you to sin, then you deal with it. You don't use your hand in that way. You don't go to that place. You cut off your feet in that sense. You get drastic about it because the sinful flesh can lead us down into paths that turn us away from the Lord's plan for our life. Billy Graham, he said one time, sex, money, and pride, those are the things that Satan will often attack on God's servants the most. So he said, so I never rode in a car alone with a woman. I never ate a meal with my secretary alone. Never rode in a car with her alone. You look at a guy like Billy Graham and you think, you know, man, that was a man who by God's grace had integrity. He didn't fall into things like a lot of other well-known Christians. And of course there's others that God has used like that as well. But was it because he was above the temptation that he didn't fall? No. 1 Corinthians 10 says, be careful lest you think you won't fall. No, he understood he could fall. And so he was vigilant. That's Jesus' point. He was vigilant. He was cautious. He was humble. He walked humbly. He told a man one time, what's the secret to walking in faithfulness? And he said, I walk scared, young man. I walk scared. In the fear of the Lord. Not afraid of God, but in a fear and awe of Him. And a daily dependence on Him. Realizing how we depend on Christ to walk in faith. Thinking on the things that are pure and good and lovely. As Paul said in Philippians 4. We learn to take drastic measures when it's necessary. When those areas are causing us to sin, that's Jesus' point here. You don't go on in that area. You walk in faith and you walk in seriousness. And then finally, as we close, maximize your marriage. And relationships as well, but especially marriage. Jesus is saying focus on the positive here. When he talks about the idea of the eye here, he's talking about a single-mindedness. You realize that? When he talks about Michael Wilkins, he said, through hyperbole, deliberate exaggeration, Jesus emphasizes the seriousness of single-hearted devotion, single-eye devotion, single-handed commitment to your spouse. In other words, no one else is to have our eyes when in marriage. Paul said an elder is to be a husband of one wife. In other words, a one-woman man. And see, that's the way it's supposed to be for a woman too. She's to have only eyes for her husband. There's a focus that Jesus says we're to have here. We maximize marriages. We want to focus on the positive of what God will do for them. And this is what we can do to encourage other people as well in their marriages in the church. And to encourage them and help them as God leads us to grow in marriage. Because as we grow in the positive, we really understand why God gave the commandment in the first place. Maximizing marriages in homes, in churches. And the impact of that points people to the beauty of God's love for His church. So let's turn to Him now as we close and ask for His grace.